पार्थाय प्रतिबोधिदां भगवता नारायणेन स्वयं व्यासेन ग्रथितां पुराणमुनिना मध्ये महाभारतम् अद्वैतामृतवर्षिणीं भगवतीं अष्टादशाध्यायिनीं अम्बत्वामनुसन्दधामि भगवद्गीते भवद्वेषिणी ओ भगवद्गीता विथ विच पार्थ वाज एनलाइटेंड बाय द लॉर्ड नारायण हिमसेल्फ and which was incorporated in the Mahabharata by the ancient sage Vyasa, the blessed mother, the destroyer of rebirth and miseries, showering down the nectar of Advaita, and consisting of 18 chapters upon the Bhagavad Gita, or Divine Mother, I meditate. So yesterday, we were dealing with the 69th verse, which is supposed to be one of the most celebrated verses in the whole text. it is a clue to becoming a person of spiritual wisdom. Apuryamanam achala pradishtham samudramapa pravishanti yadvat tadvat kamayam pravishanti sarve sa shantim apnoti na kama kami. This is the verse. So you have to think of an imagery. It's a grand illustration. Think of a mighty ocean, calm and quiet, very deep and very wide. And innumerable rivers, not streams, huge rivers, Mississippi, Brahmaputra, Nile, huge rivers, river bodies, empty their waters into this ocean. But the ocean remains calm and quiet. Now, the ocean doesn't invite the rivers to pour their waters in the ocean. When the rivers empty their waters into the ocean doesn't reject either. It neither invites nor rejects. But it is unaffected. It remains calm and quiet. Now, how is the ocean able to remain calm and quiet? If it is a small pool of water, if it is a small pond, then even a small stream can cause flooding, landslides, and so on. The banks of the ocean never overflow. But the banks of a small pond will overflow. Even if a small river empties its waters into it. But the ocean remains calm and quiet. It never invites the rivers to come and bring their waters into it. It doesn't say no to the rivers when they bring the waters. Similarly, a man or a woman of spiritual wisdom, an illumined person, can live in this world, need not be attached to the world. Desires, temptations, different ideas may present themselves before him or her. The illumined person, the spiritually elevated person, doesn't reject, but never welcomes them. It remains unaffected. Is this possible for anyone to live like that? That's a question. Now, devotional classics give some very interesting psychological insights as to how this ability can be cultivated. Before then, I can just refer to an important idea which Shankaracharya presents in the Viveka Chudamani, a small foundational text which is called Prakarana Grantha. He says, Manushyattvam, Mumukshuttvam, Mahapurusha Samsrayaka. These are the three important blessings, characteristics, which are very rare in this world. And from a devotional point of view, the rarest is Mahapurusha Samsreha means an opportunity to associate with holy people, an opportunity to associate with, to talk to interact with fellow spiritual pilgrims, people who are interested in spiritual life. Elsewhere, in some of his celebrated commentaries, Shankaracharya says that this alone can be a unique blessing. See, Manishutva means the opportunity to be born as a human being. Mumukshutvam means an intense desire for spiritual enlightenment, liberation. Now, these two alone are not enough. And even if you do not have either of these two, still, if you get an opportunity to interact with people who are interested in spiritual life, it will be very helpful to you. And devotional classics, in their own unique style, gives a psychological insight as to why we fail to be benefited by listening to lectures, by meditation, and by spiritual practices. One important point they make again and again is, see, we often, due to our accumulated good karmas, merits, or previous activities, activities in previous life or in this life, we sometimes develop an intense desire to lead a spiritual life, to give a new spiritual orientation to our life. And then we start practicing spirituality, meditation, reading scriptures, and listening to expositions of spiritual ideas. And these activities create a storehouse of positive tendencies. They enrich, they reinforce our inherent spiritual tendencies. But then what happens, you know? Then we go and associate with people who will tell you, oh, what is there in spirituality? There is not much. Why should we bother about meditation and all this? Then, you know, everything is upside down. So if you collect nectar in a huge pot and you forget to repair the pot, you know, but there's a huge hole at the bottom of the pot. If you just collect water in a pot, and if there's a hole at the bottom, then you may go on pouring water into the pot, but it will be empty. So it's very important to associate directly and indirectly with people who are like-minded, who have got spiritual tendencies, who are fellow spiritual pilgrims. These ideas are repeated again and again in classical mystical works like Philokalia. Again and again. Of course, in the mystical works, negative ideas or influence of negative people, skeptics, you know, cynical people, they will say, all right, meditation, listening to all these things. But then they will have a contemptuous laughter. Oh, these do not really mean much. If you listen once to such undesirable persons, all your efforts will be neutralized. This is one important reason why people, especially the beginners, fail to make spiritual progress. This idea is repeated again and again in the ancient Hindu devotional classics like Bhagavata, Narada Bhakti Sutras, Chandilya Bhakti Sutras, and also, interestingly, in the great devotional classics of the Christian mystics, Philokalia, Brothers Lawrence works, and sometimes you find in the City of God, St. Augustine's classic. Sometimes how people get drawn to a city of evil, city of Satan, leaving behind a city of God. Means sattvic qualities, what we call desire, spiritually useful tendencies are left behind, and we move towards spiritually harmful tendencies. So that's why again and again it's very important not only to listen to spiritual ideas, not only to get familiar with spiritually elevating teachings, but very important to associate with people who are like-minded, who are interested in spiritual life. And much more important, to avoid associating with people who are of the opposite type, who will draw you away from spiritual tendencies. I have already referred to some classics, you know. One of the greatest devotional classics in Vedantic tradition, Hindu tradition, is Bhagavata Purana. We just got 12 sections. Each section is called a skandha. You find sometimes the translations are available. S-K-A-N-D-H-A, skandha means section. There are 12 sections in the Bhagavata Purana. In the 11th section, there is a very, very interesting dialogue between a great philosopher king, like the philosopher king of Plato, and 9 great enlightened sages who are sthitapragnas, as already explained, expounded in these 18 verses in the second chapter. 9 great sages on the one hand, and a great king, a learned, an enlightened king who is an intense spiritual seeker. If you come across Kabir Ahir Andariksha Prabuddha Pipalayana Avihotrodha Dumilas Chamasa Karabhajanaha Kavihi Harihi Andariksha, like that, there are 9 sages. You need not worry about the names, but in case you get a chance, you can go through the first 6 chapters of the 12th skandha, 12th section of Bhagavata Purana. From 2nd chapter till 6th chapter, in 5 chapters, this is a long discourse. English translations are available, very good English translations. You need not worry about the original text. Now, in fact, they discuss a number of topics. Some of them are highly philosophical, metaphysical. Some of them are intensely spiritual, and some of them are extremely practical and psychological from a devotional point of view. Now, among the many questions which the king puts to these 9 great sages, one important question: what are the characteristics of a great ideal devotee of God? What are the characteristics which distinguish a spiritual seeker? Now, while expounding these characteristics, the great sage Antariksha gives some very, very psychological, practical hints as to how we must be careful when we build up the edifice of our spiritual life. First, the sage Antariksha says, Sarva Bhudeshuya Pasyet Bhagavad Bhava Matmanaha Bhudani Bhagavati Atmani Esha Bhagavadottama. This is the verse. Translation is this. Who is the ideal devotee, the greatest, most sublime, most highly evolved devotee? Bhagavadottama means most sublime, most highly evolved devotee. He says, the one who experiences the presence of the Lord in all beings and the presence of all beings in God, he is the greatest devotee. He, every moment of his life or her life, the great devotee, the highest devotee, not just believes but experiences the divine presence of God in the whole creation, in the minutest of the atom and also in the largest, in amoeba and also in a Buddha. So that devotee experiences the presence, the divine spark, the divine presence of the Lord in all beings, and also experiences the presence of all beings in God. Now this is the highest state of evolution in devotional life. in spiritual life. So if you ever come across somebody, well, I pray to God, but I don't care for others. Well, that person is better than those who never care for anything other than his stomach, eating, drinking, and making merry. True, but then don't look upon him as an ideal devotee. And slightly be careful about him. Then the next verse, the great sage gives the picture of ordinary spiritual seekers. Most of the great spiritual seekers, those who take to spiritual life, most of the devotees who gather in our congregation belong to this category, the second category. They do not belong to the highest spiritual category, but they are certainly sincere spiritual seekers. Now, what they should be careful about, what they should be very, very careful about, is given in the Ishwari tad adhineshu balisheshu dishatsucha prema maitri kripa upeksha yakkarodi samadhyamaha. This is the verse. I shall translate, explain. The sage says, who is the devotee, those who belong to the middle path, middle level? They pray to God. They meditate upon God. They're devoted to God. That we should be like them. Those who are sincere seekers, who have not reached the highest level, who are certainly much more evolved than primitive people who don't care for any trans-empirical values. So Ishwara means they have their devotion to God. They pray, they meditate, they try to contemplate on God and try to lead a spiritual life. They attend retreats, they meditate, they read holy books, they discuss spiritual topics, such people. Now, and then what is their attitude towards other devotees? Friendly. They will be comrades, a camaraderie, a sense of brotherly feeling, friendliness, mutual understanding. So they should be devoted to God and they should have an attitude of friendliness, camaraderie, kind of mutual appreciation, mutual understanding. When devotees, spiritual seekers come together, they should discuss spiritual ideas, which that is a very, very helpful spiritual practice, because that reinforces our spiritual tendencies. If we discuss the opposite things, it will be pouring cold water. So they should be friendly towards other devotees. And then there are people who don't know much about spiritual ideas, but they are good people. They never attend any meditation session. They don't read holy books. They don't pray. But they don't do anything harmful to anyone. We should be sympathetic. Prema maitri karuna means we should be sympathetic towards them. If possible, if we get a chance, we should encourage them to turn to spiritual life. But we should never hate them. We should be sympathetic towards those who are not aware of the importance of leading a spiritual life. And there's a fourth category. You may be a sincere spiritual seeker. You may be working 12, 15 hours a day. Then once a week, you may be going to Vedanta Society, maybe church or any place of worship. You may be going to a meditation center, maybe Buddhist meditation center. Because you get only 1 hour a week. Somehow you struggle hard in the midst of all activities. And whenever you get some free time, you try to read some good books. And now what happens? But if you associate with like-minded people, it will be helpful. But suppose you become a close friend, companion of a cynic who criticizes everything, who demolishes all your convictions and ideas. They will tell you, why should you go to meditation centers? Why should you read these holy books? Why should you discuss spiritual ideas? It's all good for nothing or futile, absolutely. They use some strong language also to develop a kind of contempt in you to spiritual ideas. Now, Antariksha, the great sage, gives a very interesting advice. Keep a long distance from them. Prema, Maitri, Kripa, Upeksha. Prema mind means devotion. Maitri means friendliness. Kripa means sympathy. Upeksha means total conscious indifference. Conscious indifference. Deliberately, you must try to keep away from people who will try to drag you away from our chosen path. So, you cannot quarrel with them, because quarreling creates agitation, restlessness. But you cannot be very friendly with them. They will convert you to their path. If you become very close to them, then slowly you will start finding excuses for not meditating, for not going to meditation centers, Vedanta society or spiritual, centers. And slowly your mind will be automatically colored, influenced by their ideas. Sri Ramakrishna, the great teacher of Swami Vivekananda, gives a strong warning. He says, suppose there's a dirty room full of filth and bad smell, and you are wearing clean white clothes, just fresh from laundry. And do you think you can enter the dirty room and come out without some trace of dirt or filth or bad smell? People will run away from you. You may not know. The reason is you have come out of that room. Similarly, we can never associate with undesirable companions and friends without hurting your spiritual tendencies. These are some of the strong warnings which should be kept in mind when we study scriptures like this. So, here look at this verse, Apuryamanam Achala Pradishtam. Shankaracharya says, Apuryamanam Adbhihi Achala Pradishtam Achalataya Pradishtha Avasthidihi Yasyatam Achala Pradishtam Samudram Apaha Sarvodogataha Pravishanti Swatmastham Avikriyameva Santam Yatvat. I shall explain this in detail. Tadvat Kamaha Visheshannithu Api Sarvada Icha Visheshaha Yam Purusham Samudram Iva Apaha Avikurvantaha Pravishanti Sarve Atmani Eva Praliyanti Naswatmavasham Kurvanti. It's a very Shankaracharya gives some insight. How is it possible for us to remain calm and quiet? Now the point is, if we identify ourselves with this body, we cannot keep quiet. We cannot but be restless. Because body and mind and intellect are affected by whatever happens around us. If there is a situation, if there is a condition in our life which creates agitation, and if we identify ourselves with our mind, then mind will become agitated. Because very often in our day-to-day activities, we are what we consider ourselves to be. We are what we consider ourselves to be. If we think we are this body, we are this mind, we are the intellect, then the slightest agitation, not physical, psychological agitation, ideas, negative ideas, desires, all these will agitate the mind. Then our mind will not remain calm and quiet. It's like a huge river entering a small pond. The pond will overflow. There will be high tides and landslides. If a number of very big rivers enter a small bay, there will be tsunami. But if 1,000 rivers like Mississippi, Brahmaputra, or Nile, if they all empty the waters into Pacific, the Pacific Ocean will not be affected. There will be no landslides, no overflowing, no waves or no tides. Similarly, if we identify ourselves with something big, vast, and all-pervading, the Atman, the Brahman, then Whatever comes to our mind will not affect us. Because we do not think we are the mind. We are something beyond the mind, beyond the body, beyond the intellect. We are the all-pervading, immanent, transcendental reality, the supreme consciousness. In fact, that is the secret of the great work done by the great spiritual personalities of the world. Maybe one classic example that you can get is Mahatma Gandhi. Now, Mahatma Gandhi is technically, is not formally recognized as a saint, like Jesus, Buddha, Shankaracharya, Sri Ramakrishna, Swami Vivekananda. Mahatma Gandhi was intensely active, right in the midst of the world. He was not living in the forests. Most of the time he was busy organizing Indians against the British colonies to get Indian freedom. But Gandhi never felt agitated. But it is said that Gandhiji repeated again and again this idea. I mean, whenever he had any problem or conflict or agitation in mind, he used to turn to the pages of Gita as a child turns to his mother for consolation, for relief. And he used to meditate upon the 18 verses, these verses, the Prakin Lakshana means these verses, he used to meditate deeply. The verses that we are discussing in this retreat session. So, and as I said, you know, he was in the midst of all activities. So once C.F. Andrews, who was perhaps an Englishman, a close devotee and a disciple and associate of Gandhi, asked him, Gandhi, why don't you go on any vacation, take a rest or something? Gandhi used to sleep only for 4 or 5 hours a day. And the old man was busy the rest of the day and never agitated, calm and quiet. So Gandhi replied, and he said, C.F. Andrews continued, are you not tired any time? The Gandhi, who is tired? Now, in the midst of all these activities, somehow at the back of his mind, he had the feeling that he is something other than the frail body that he was carrying, or the mind or the intellect. Behind all this, he had the conviction he is something beyond and above all this, the all-pervading Supreme Atman. Of course, that Vedantic idea, so far as Gandhi was concerned, was his devotion to Lord Rama. That's why when he was shot 3 times, he did not cry or weep. He chanted the name of God. He did not cry or weep. So somebody who could take the name of God when breathing, when shot 3 times, when facing death in the eyes, and take the name of God, that person should have been taking the name of God all his life. That's the explanation. So, like a mighty ocean, he could remain. There was absolutely no agitation. In the, in this Munduga Upanishad, there is a famous verse, Yatha nadya syantamana samudri astam gvichyanti namarupi vikaya tatha vidvan namarupa vimuktaha parat param purusham upayati divyam. It comes in Munduga Upanishad. It means, the meaning is this. When they rivers, the infinite number of rivers, when they empty their waters in the ocean, they lose their distinct identities. For example, suppose we imagine Nile, Mississippi, Brahmaputra, Ganga, Volga, suppose all these rivers, just imagine, empty the waters in the ocean. Once the waters have entered the ocean, merged with the ocean, then their distinct identities, name and form, vanish. They become one with the ocean. If we can look upon ourselves as that all-pervading reality, which remains unagitated, free from anxieties, which remains calm and quiet and perfect tranquility, in spite of so many calls, so many agitations, so many temptations, so many duties and responsibilities, and conflicts, then we have become spiritually evolved in the true sense of the term. But very often, you know what happens? we can become terribly agitated even while doing nothing. So if you most of you are driving almost every day, at least 100 miles and maybe more. So we get caught in a traffic jam. And if you have to remain there for 1 or 2 hours, you may be sitting in the car. You are not working very hard. You are sitting in a comfortable seat. But then you will be terribly agitated. Oh, how long it's going to take? What a problem. I mean, you will be cursing this traffic. And as you go on cursing, as you go on getting agitated, more and more conflicts, more and more tension will be building up within the mind, though you are doing nothing. So doing nothing, one can get agitated. One can get tense. And people like Gandhi or Jesus or Buddha or Shankara, Ramakrishna Paramahansa, Vivekananda, they have been working all their life. As I said, no, Shankara lived for 32 years, Christ for 30 years, and Swami Vivekananda for 39 years. What all they accomplished, we still remember them, we still read about them, we still think about them, we still try to follow them one way or other. And they lived for very, very short periods. And they worked so hard, but they were not agitated. Here we are sitting in a comfortable seat in a car, doing nothing. We are building up agitation and conflicts within. So it is possible for one to be in the midst of all activities, mentally, physically, and intellectually, and remain calm and quiet. It is also possible to remain doing nothing and to get more and more agitated, more and more disturbed, more and more tense. Two opposite pictures you can see here. Now we will go to the next verse. That is also very important. that is the 71st one. Vihaya kaman yas sarvan pumam sarati nispraha nirmamo nirakankaraha sa shantim adhigacchati. Who gets this ultimate peace of mind? The one who has given up all desires. You should understand, attachment to all desires. That's the idea behind. The one who has given up all attachment to all desires and remains without any longing. And the one who doesn't identify himself with anything. He doesn't go about identifying something as his or her property. And who has no sense of egoism. Such a person gets ultimate tranquility of the mind. This is the idea behind. Here, see, the meaning is this. The one who gives up all desires. Now, try to understand this in the light of the previous verse. As I said, you know, the ocean remains calm and quiet. The rivers empty their waters into the ocean. The ocean is not affected. Does the ocean ask the river not to come to it, not to empty the waters in it? No. The ocean doesn't reject the river, the waters. But the ocean doesn't go out of its way to attract or to receive or to accept the waters. Mechanically, the waters empty themselves into the ocean. The rivers empty the waters into the ocean. The ocean remains calm and quiet. So here you find the ocean is in a perfect state of absolute non-attachment. It is this non-attachment that makes it possible for spiritual seekers to remain calm and quiet. But we have to remember what we discussed earlier. This state of tranquility can be sustained only if we go on working hard to enrich and to strengthen and to fortify these spiritual tendencies by reading these books and by associating with people who share similar spiritual aspirations. and by not associating with people who are opposed to such spiritual ideas, because they can take us away from our spiritual tendencies. Spiritually, they can do terrible harm to beginners in spiritual life. That is the warning given by all great devotional classics. Most of the devotees, most of the beginners suffer in spite of their great intensity, in spite of their great sincerity, purity, absolute unselfishness. In spite of all this, they suffer because they cannot say no when a person of negative tendencies, an undesirable element, comes and tells, well, you don't care for these spiritual things. That's why Yatishwaranandaji, in his addresses, mostly addressed to Western audiences in America, in Philadelphia, and also in Europe, Germany, and other places where he worked, he said, we have to keep a filtering mechanism with him. So that automatically we can filter out and avoid, automatically reject harmful ideas, harmful associations, thereby keep steadfast to positive spiritual tendencies. This is the idea behind. And that's why in this context, the great spiritual teachers have stressed the importance of mind. It's mind that ultimately matters in spiritual life. How we train our mind. Because before reaching the highest spiritual identification with Atman, we are all living at mental level. Most people are living at the mental level. I mean, I'm talking about spiritual seekers. Others live maybe at the sensory level. And this mind is what really matters. And there is a famous verse in Sanskrit which is very famous. So I'll try to explain. Manohi dividham proktam shuddham cha ashuddham evacha ashuddham kama sankalpam shuddham kama vivarjitam manaeva manushyanam karanam bendhamokshayohu bendhaya vishayasaktam mukti nirvishayam smritam. This comes from one of the minor Upanishads. The point is this. Mind is our best friend if we can train our mind properly. And mind is our worst enemy if we do not train it properly. If mind is dragged by the senses, it becomes the worst enemy. If mind is able to control the senses, it becomes the best friend. So that's why the ancient verse says, mind is of two types, the pure and the impure. The impure mind means a mind which is distracted. The eyes take the mind towards some undesirable visual objects. Ears take the mind towards undesirable audio objects. And the sense of touch will take the mind towards certain objects. In fact, as I said 2 days back, while expounding that famous verse, Shabdadipi Pancha Bhireva Pancha Dibhyaga Chudamani. All the time, every minute, our mind is being dragged by the 5 senses of perception towards different sense objects. And mind becomes impure. On the other hand, if mind can be given a spiritual orientation, it becomes the best friend. So mind becomes a tool, a means for spiritual liberation if the mind associates itself with spiritual ideas, and if the mind associates itself with other minds which are like-minded, which are, I mean, with people who are fellow spiritual pilgrims in our life. That's why association with fellow devotees, fellow spiritual pilgrims is stressed in all devotional classical literature. Association with fellow pilgrims, those who have started the spiritual journey as we have started, those who are heading towards the same direction, because that kind of discussion and contact will reinforce our own spiritual tendencies. Now, of course, here, very often, we have to remember, it is not any kind of forced asceticism or suppression of the natural tendencies of the mind. Psychology, from a psychological point of view, you will read in books on psychology that any kind of forced suppression, in spiritual traditions, forced asceticism, starvation of the senses, suppressing the natural tendencies of the mind artificially, without feeding the mind with good thoughts, it is not spiritual practice. What is needed is mind should be fed with positive tendencies. Our mind is like a bag. In Vedanta, as I said earlier, we believe in rebirth and law of karma. Whatever we do consciously, with perfect identification that we are doing something, that we want to enjoy the results of this work, it creates a strong impression in our mind. It's called chitta. So, we have inherited a huge bag full of tendencies and impressions. Some of them are very good, that's why we are here. Some of them not so very good. So, mind is full of positive and negative tendencies, good and bad impressions. Now, how to counteract the effects of, the influence of negative tendencies? It's a very usual, normal question discussed in spiritual books and spiritual gatherings. How do we succeed in counteracting negative tendencies? Sometimes negative tendencies can come in the form of lethargy, procrastination, postponement. Even if we sincerely try, from another corner of the mind, well, let us do it next some other time. Which shows there are some other tendencies which are pulling the mind in that direction, away from spiritual direction. It's a real proof which shows that there are mutually contradictory, conflicting streams of thought currents, tendencies and impressions accumulated in the mind. Now, how do we counteract the effect of negative tendencies? One, we have already discussed, by associating with fellow spiritual pilgrims, other devotees. Another and maybe much more important method is to accumulate or to try consciously to accumulate positive tendencies by deliberately doing good work. Good work could mean reading holy books, discussing holy thoughts, maybe making deliberate conscious efforts to seek out people who discuss spiritual topics, who will not discuss negative ideas, who are not cynical, who will not drag you away from your chosen path, who will help you in your own spiritual ideas by reinforcing our positive tendencies. Now, in this way, if we can feed our mind again and again with more and more spiritual tendencies, spiritual impressions, then the weight of the spiritual tendencies will be more than the weight of the impact of the negative tendencies. Means negative tendencies will be weakened, and positive tendencies, spiritually useful, spiritually helpful tendencies and impressions will be strengthened, enriched, reinforced. That's one way to counteract the effect of negative impressions and tendencies. This is one method that is stressed again and again in many spiritual topics. So whatever I see, somehow try to connect that with God or spirituality, Vedantic ideal or spiritual life in general. And whatever we hear, try to establish a link with what we hear with spiritual life. Whatever activities we are doing, we can do that. Some time back, I think somebody raised this question, so I referred to the five verses in the Bhagavad Gita, the 12th chapter, 8th, 9th, 10th and 11th, four verses. In a descending order, Lord Krishna gives four alternatives. In fact, the most primary, the first step in spiritual life is the approach explained in the 11th verse, in the 12th chapter. We can see Bhakti Yoga, 12th chapter. In the 11th verse, Lord Krishna says, if you cannot keep your mind and intellect always in God, in spiritual life, spiritual realm, and if you cannot divert all your activities, activities of the senses of perception and senses of action towards spiritual ideal, and if you cannot look upon all your work as God's work, then just do your work and mentally leave the result to God. Sarva karma parityagam, that's meaning here. Atha edadapi ashaktosi kartum madhyogam ashidaha sarva karma phalatyagam, that's meaning in the 11th verse. This is the first step. Here we can begin. And slowly we can develop the attitude that whatever I do is God's work. And that will help us to associate whatever we do with some divine spiritual ideal. And if we can really establish an ideal in our life, if we can choose an ideal and orient all our life and activities towards that ideal, that has got a great benefit. Even if you cannot accept realization of God or spiritual unfoldment as the supreme ideal, many people cannot do. Even if you can say, do something good for your own good, some sense of achievement. If you are a painter, try to write, try to create a masterly creation. If you are a writer, try to write a book which will be remembered by humanity. If you are a great worker, try to accomplish something which will be good for you and good for others. Any kind of high ideal will have the effect of giving us a focus for mental and intellectual and physical energies, because that will help us to prevent draining away of our energy resources. Otherwise, mind will be full of conflicts and agitations. If you have no ideal in life, not necessarily spiritual ideal, though that is the most desirable one, even for people who cannot accept a spiritual ideal as the supreme destination, supreme ideal. For others, if they can aim at something big, grand and sublime, something really good, which will not be bad for anybody, which will not be harmful to anyone, something really grand, beautiful and sublime, if you can aim at, you find all your energy resources, nervous energy, mental energy, physical energy, will be focused, will be given an orientation in that direction. Otherwise, you know what happens? The drainage of energy, energies will be drained out, drained away. Nervous energy, psychological energy, and intellectual energy. That's why people cannot read great books and remember. Because while reading, they were also thinking something else. On the other hand, those who accomplished great things, they were focusing all their energies in one direction. Such people can understand the importance and relevance of spiritual ideal much better. Because they have, at the intellectual level and psychological, mental level, they have been successful in focusing their energy in one direction. Even to discover or invent a great scientific formula or theory or anything which will give a forward leap to human civilization, or writing a classic, or as I said, you know, if you're a painter, painting a classic master only work, all these can give us a kind of focus orientation. So aim at something big and high and ideal, and then you find the highest, the most sublime and the most beautiful are the spiritual ideals. A great philosophical work is certainly grand and great. A great scientific discovery is also great and sublime. A great painting is also, no doubt. But there is, which painting is greater than these phenomena? The universe, which is itself a creation of God. Can there be anything greater than the universe? Can anything excel this universe in sublimity, in grandeur, in beauty, or in whatever other attributes you can think of? So God is the greatest painter in that sense. He's the greatest philosopher. He's the greatest creative artist. So that will take us to a higher spiritual idea. In the Rigveda Samhita, there is an interesting verse. I won't go into those mantras, it will take a long time. The idea is this. Anybody who can think of something high, sublime, beautiful, grand, and good for ourselves and good for others, can graduate to the next stage of finding a higher spiritual ideal, God. Because it is said, you know, for the highest spiritual artist, the world becomes a temple. Every act becomes an act of meditation. Every thought becomes an act of meditation. Every word becomes a prayer. So that's why in some of the classical literature it is said, first we must choose a high ideal. We should be high, beautiful, grand. And one important point, which will somehow help us to focus and put together our energies in one direction. And at next stage, this focus can be the highest spiritual ideal. That's the idea behind. I think today we have just about 5 minutes more. So, I have not come to the last verse, but I would like to refer to a grand statement which Shankaracharya makes in the last verse. The last verse is something like this. One who reaches this high, sublime ideal of spiritual peace, tranquility, which is eternal, that person will be liberated. If he reaches that stage, or she reaches that stage, at the end of the life, he'll be liberated. But we should not wait till the end of the life. We should start at the beginning itself. Because death is nothing but a natural departure from life. And the way we die depends upon the way we live. The last verse refers to one important point. This highest spiritual state, attaining which a spiritually elevated person becomes free from all delusions. And at the end of his life, he attains what you call Brahma Nirvanam Ruchati. That's a meaning. I'm not come to this verse, we'll discuss later. But the idea is this. Shankaracharya, in his masterly commentary, says how much better it is for one to reach this stage when you are very young, when you are not old. So we should not wait till old age for spiritual practice. That's the idea behind. As I said, you know, I shall explain this earlier. Death is the sum total of our life. In Vedanta, it is said that whatever impressions and ideas that we have, that we confront at the time of death, will be rooted on whatever thoughts and ideas we have already developed in our life. Because when mind is completely out of control, when the body is completely in a helpless state, whatever natural tendencies we have accumulated in mind will come to the surface. So to be able to leave this world with a smile on the face, with holy thought in mind, one should lead a life which should be a preparation for the highest spiritual destination. We will come to that later, but Shankaracharya says, किमु वक्तव्यं ब्रह्मचर्यादेव सन्यस्य यावज्जीवं यो ब्रह्मणि एव अवतिष्ठति स ब्रह्मनिर्वाणं पृच्छति इति. At end, this Chittaprajna will reach Brahma Nirvanam, in liberation. So, but how much better, how much more desirable it is for one to start the spiritual journey and reach this destination, not at time of death, but much earlier, during the early part of one's life, Brahmacharya Ashrama. This is the implication. We will discuss this subject. We have two more days and two more verses, which are very important, which are from a metaphysical and spiritual point of view, which are immortal verses in this text. Now we'll have discussion for half an hour.
Swami, when you were speaking a little earlier, I was reminded of these verses from the, I think it's a Sufi mystic,
yes.
Ansari of Herat, and they say, in this path, the eye must cease to see, and the ear to hear, save unto him and about him.
Yes, yes. So all the thoughts and all the activities of the five senses, the eyes, ears, touch, sense of smell, sense of taste, all the five senses of perception and mind and intellect will be focused on the supreme spiritual ideal. So that person won't see anything other than his chosen ideal, won't hear about anything other than his chosen ideal. So the interpretation is, in the Sufi tradition, is it interpreted devotion philosophy also, not that the person hears only about God from an empirical point of view. Whatever he hears or sees or experiences, he will somehow associate with divine chosen ideal. So that's it. If he sees something beautiful, nature, it will remind him of the great creator who has created this beautiful universe. In Sri Ramakrishna's Gospel, Sri Ramakrishna refers to one interesting episode that happened in his life. He was living in Dakshineswar, the banks of the river, you know. So once a great avadhuta means a wandering mendicant who looks upon life itself as a spiritual journey. He won't stay anywhere. He will eat whatever is given to him or her. And who looks upon the whole universe as God, temple and so on. So he used to go to the he went to the Ganga, took a deep, did not remove water. Then he was dancing. And he was looking at the grandeur, the sublimity of the Ganges flowing nearby, the rivers, the trees, the huge structure of the temple, everything, and he was smiling and dancing. Because for him, the whole universe is an occasion for celebration. Because everything in the universe reminds him of God. Everything in the universe reminds him of God. So, that's why we have, again, in fact, this verse reinforces the idea that we repeated again and again. There are people for whom everything in this world is a reminder of God's presence. And there are people for whom everything in this world is an opportunity to move away from God. Both you find both extremes. So, the highest devotee is one for whom everything in this world, the plurality, the diversity, the sublimity, the beauty, the grandeur, everything reminds him of an all-pervading reality behind the universe. So everything he associates with the grand creator. Such ideas are found in the devotional classics of mystics, Gnostics. The next verse will come, Yanisa Sarvabhudanam, yes, Tasyam Jagrati Samyami. We have not come to that stage. I didn't go to that verse. You find, of course, we will deal with that verse later. Yanisha sarvabhudanam tasyam jagrati samyami yasyam jagrati bhudani sanisha pasyato munihi. The meaning is this. For a devotee, for a spiritual seeker, God is the reality. God is the day. He remains in a state, he is always awakened, is wide awake to a spiritual ideal, and is completely asleep towards the world. The world is non-existent for him. God alone exists. I can quote from a Gnostic work, Sufi. See, this is the description of the Gnostic or the Sufi given by Nicholson, Mystics of Islam. See, at night prisoners forget their prison. At night kings forget their power. No sorrow, no brooding over gain and loss. No thought of the person or that person. This is the state of the Gnostic. Even when he is awake, God has said, "Thou wouldst deem them awake while they sleep." He is asleep day and night to the affairs of the world. So when you are asleep, means when you are asleep to the world, you are not wide awake to the world. You are wide awake to God, to the divine reality. Then you are in total darkness, you are in deep sleep, so far as the world is concerned. So those who do not have spiritual tendencies are wide awake to the affairs of the world and completely asleep towards the divine, to God. And those who are spiritually enlightened, they are completely in total darkness with regard to the world. They are always awakened with regard to spirituality. That's the idea. That we'll discuss, that's a verse we're going to discuss.
Swamiji,
Swamiji,
there is a verse in the Bhagavad Gita which says,
Nispraha actually means having no desire. No desire, no attachment. No desire. It's actually an enumeration, it's an exposition of the previous verse. As you know, അപൂര്യമാണം അചലപ്രതിഷ്ഠം സമുദ്രമാപ്രവിശന്തി തദ്ദുക്കാമായം പ്രവിശന്തി സർവേ സ ശാന്തിമാപ്നോതി ന കാമകാമി സ ഇമേജറി ഹ്യൂജ് വാട്ടർ ബോഡി മൈറ്റി ഓഷ്യൻ സോ ബിഗ് സോ വൈഡ് സോ കാം സോ ക്വൈറ്റ് അബ്സല്യൂട്ട്ലി നോ മോഷൻ നത്തിങ് ഇൻ പെർഫെക്റ്റ് ട്രാങ്ക്വലിറ്റി ആൻഡ് സോ മെനി അജിറ്റേറ്റിംഗ് റിവേഴ്സ് ഫുൾ ഓഫ് വേവ്സ് ആൻഡ് ടൈഡ്സ് ആൻഡ് ടർബുലൻറ്റ് ടൈഡ്സ് ആൻഡ് വേവ്സ് They all empty their waters into this mighty, peaceful ocean. The ocean is completely untouched. The ocean doesn't invite the rivers. But the ocean is not running away from the rivers. So you need not run away from the world to enjoy peace of mind. One can apparently run away from the world and pretend to be enjoying peace of mind. Such a person is called a hypocrite. In Gita, I'm not blaming that person. Karmendriyani samyamya ye aste manasasmaran indriyarthan vimudhatma mithyachara sauchi. The meaning is this. A person who is full of desire, attachment, but not willing to work. Suppose he says, well, what's the use of money? But if you give him $5, he's ready to accept. And he may even work for $5. Then you should ask him to work hard. But then he says, no, what's the use of money? So when it comes to work, he says no. But he sits quiet. His mind is always brooding over desires, objects of enjoyment and desires, for which he is not willing to work. So deliberately, forcibly, he has suppressed his senses of action, senses of perception. This kind of forcible, deliberate, artificial withdrawal from activities, that is not spirituality. That person should first work hard, fulfill his desires, and then should start doing without desires. Then he will become a real karma yogi, and then ultimately he will get peace of mind. So see, it is not our choice, it's a matter of our evolution. It's not a matter of our choice. If you go to a market, you can buy whatever you want. You can buy oranges, you can buy apples. In spirituality, you cannot have your own choice. You have to do what according to your spiritual fitness. So a very active person who can work hard, who is used to doing hard work, if he simply remains inactive, withdraws himself from all actions, and then says that I am not interested in anything, but mentally always brooding over desires and objects of enjoyment. That's why, you know, Gita, Krishna says, Karmendriyani samyamya yaste manas manasas maran indriyarthan. Yeha indriyarthan manasas maran aste. That's the prasada. Means a person is always brooding over sense enjoyments, but doing nothing. And Krishna has a very strong word to use. Mithyachara means hypocrite. So that is no place in spiritual life. Here you find the ocean is in a state of perfect tranquility. It doesn't reject the rivers when they empty the waters into it. It doesn't go after the rivers. When it comes, it accepts. It remains in a state of perfect non-attachment. This non-attachment enables the sthita prajna, the ocean, to remain in a state of perfect tranquility. So, you know, we must be able to remain in a world full of activities, still enjoying perfect peace of mind. Here, there is a psychological point involved. There are some people who tell you, well, I cannot keep quiet for 1 minute. As if they are boasting, I am a very active person. A person who cannot keep quiet for 1 minute is as stupid as a person who cannot do any work. You should be able to enjoy quietude also, just as you should be able to enjoy hard work. So, both belong to the same category. There are people who cannot do any work, and there are people who cannot remain quiet for one split second. Both belong to the same category from a spiritual point of view. Maybe the word is a bit too strong, but Krishna would not have minded. He would not mind if he used that language, because he uses the word mithyacharana.
Yes.
So one should be able to work hard, and one should be able to desist from doing work. Both are necessary. That is the sign of this sthita prajna. That's the idea behind.
Swami.
It means no egotism, no ego, nothing. You question?
Well, Swami, I might have missed something there. You said it's not a matter of choice, it's a matter of evolution.
Oh, yes.
I would think it would be a matter of choice and evolution.
Yeah,
we need to be continually
actively choosing. Yes, yes. I was speaking in the context of Gita. Now, if you look at Gita background, you'll understand. Arjuna thought it's a matter of choice. You know what Arjuna did? Arjuna was a soldier. He wanted to forcibly, by military power, he wanted to gain the half the kingdom, which really belonged to the Pandavas. For that he came to the battlefield. But seeing the soldiers, his own kinsmen, his own elders, he says, well, I'm seeing all my friends around me, so I'm not willing to fight. If you just look at the 28th verse of the Gita, Dushtvemam Sujanam Krishna, etc. And then, you know what Arjuna does? He doesn't say, I'm withdrawing from battle. If he has made a straightforward statement, well, I'm going away, Krishna perhaps would not have dragged him back. What Arjuna does is, na kamshe vijayam Krishna, na cha rajyam sukhanicha. What's the use of kingdom, confers victory? And then, you know what he does? In the second chapter, there is a famous verse. Arjuna says, I am not eva mukta rishikesham gudakesha parandava na yorsa idigovindam uktva tushnim babhuva. the seventh verse, maybe seventh or ninth verse of the second chapter, Arjuna tells Krishna, well, I won't fight. Now, the justification for his decision, he gives the first chapter itself. That he says, I am not interested in kingdom or comforts. Then why did he come to the battlefield to fight? Suppose a great ascetic like Buddha had made a statement, Krishna would not have any issue with that. But Arjuna is a soldier, and his duty was to protect the women folk, the poor people, the suffering people from these evildoers, the Kauravas. So when confronted with a daunting duty and responsibility, he not only withdraws from battle, he gives a philosophical justification for that withdrawal.
Yes.
And you know what he says? He says, I will rather be a beggar. I will live by begging. But he is not a man of renunciation. Arjuna uses the word bhiksha mabhika loki. He says, Guru nahatvahi mahanubhavan shreyo bhuktum bhiksha mabhika loki. Statement in Gita, very interesting. You know what Arjuna says? Instead of killing these people, if I withdraw from battle, go away, and if I have to live like a beggar, that is better for me. But he is not a man of renunciation.
Right.
So he thought the problems of action can be avoided by running away from action. His duty was full of problems, difficulties. That is the main problem. Because so much of attachment, and then he was a bit afraid of fighting great warriors like Bhishma, Drona and Karna, who were superior to him. So little bit of fear was there. That's one interpretation, some of the minor tikas, minor commentaries. So here Arjuna is not a very straightforward person. That's why he called him hypocrite. Instead of withdrawing from the battle, he gives a philosophical justification for inaction. And he also gives the reason, this action duty is full of problems and difficulties.
Yes.
So I can avoid the problems of action by avoiding actions. Krishna says, no. You cannot run away from problems of action by running away from action. You have to act, face the problems, and then you can go beyond the problems. So the only path to go beyond problems is to face them. So, because Arjuna was not a man of renunciation. From a spiritual point of view, he was a very ordinary person. He was not like Vidura or Bhishma or the great Uddhava or Buddha or Jesus or Shankaracharya or Ramakrishna like that. He was a very, very ordinary person, man of action, if somebody had given him, you take this kingdom, he would have accepted. But he was not willing to fight. So, for such a man, what should he do? If a lazy man sits somewhere, healthy person, if he will ask you for $5-$10. If you ask him, why don't you work? He says, no. But he says, what's the use of money? What's the use of money? A Bill Gates can say, what's the use of money? If a poor beggar who will beg you for $10 has no right to say, what is the use of money? Money is not everything. There is something beyond money. So you should work hard, gain some money, then give it up. Then he will reach true spiritual status, renunciation. So that's why it's not a matter of our choice. Arjuna's level of evolution demanded that you should work hard. Then go on beyond work. That's the point. It's not a matter of our choice, it's a matter of our evolution. But there are great spiritual personalities for whom the choice and evolution are same. But they are aware of where they stand, but not Arjuna.
Well, and in other situations, just in our day-to-day lives, we are continually being presented with options.
Yes.
And making the correct choice
is
all about our choice. Our evolution leads us to those that array of choices.
Yes.
And guides are the choice we may make, but we still can make right or wrong ones.
Yes. But true spiritual seekers, their choice and their evolution will be the same. There are people who are not always sincere. They look for a higher ideal than what they actually should start with. So it's not an arbitrary decision, you know.
Mm-hmm.
Sincere spiritual seekers will understand what they deserve. So that's why, as I said, you know, a lazy man, if he says, I'm not willing to work, but if he's always desirous of money and everything, then that person should start working hard, get something, and then have some enjoyment, then give it up, and go ahead, that's it. If he suddenly says, I don't want anything, then he should go to a forest and be an ascetic. He's not willing to do that.
Mm-hmm.
But he wants a kingdom. See, Arjuna wanted a kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
Arjuna wanted to enjoy the world. Arjuna actually fought with Shiva himself and got a divine weapon so that he can defeat the Kauravas. That's just how the story goes. Arjuna was preparing for this battle all his life because the Pandavas were tortured. The Kauravas tried to kill them many times, set fire to the house where they're living, tried to poison Bhima and took away all the wealth. So all these things these Kauravas did. So Arjuna and Bhima both were getting ready to get back what actually what rightfully belonged to them, half the kingdom. So when confronted with a difficult situation, Arjuna tries to give a false justification. That's why Krishna, at the beginning of second chapter, uses some very strong language, not very pleasant. Many readers of Gita who don't know the meaning, they will prostrate like this and read, Klaibhyam Masmagama Partha. Actually, Krishna is scolding Arjuna in two verses. Krishna scolds Arjuna for being a hypocrite. Krishna would not have scolded Uddhava, who was a great devotee, is there in Bhagavad Gita. A great man of renunciation. Suppose a Buddha had said what Arjuna said in the first chapter, Krishna would have no difference of opinion. But Arjuna was not Buddha. Arjuna was a man about the world.
Mm-hmm.
That person has no right to speak like a Buddha before becoming Buddha. That's the idea behind.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. Okay. I think we have just 5 minutes. We have 2 more days. And roughly 2 or 3 verses, so enough time. If you want to discuss something, we'll discuss. Not necessarily related to what we discussed today, but anything in general. Yes.
Oh, Swami, I have a question. When we talk about our next life or the next lives or our past lives, is this on a time thing? I mean, if I say, oh, in my next life, am I talking about something beyond the year in which this life, this body dies? Or is it some other way of thinking of it?
Generally, in this cosmic, the transmigratory cycle, as we call it, now, our next life will depend very much upon what we do in this life, what impressions and tendencies we gather. And there could also be many tendencies and impressions that we have gathered in previous life, not necessarily in this life. So, because there are certain tendencies which are inherent. You find, if you observe our own life, our activities, you find we can't but behave in a given manner, which we cannot really explain in terms of training or education, formal education or anything. Where do we gather these inherent tendencies and impressions which constitute our character?
I understand that.
Uh-huh.
I'm talking about like the years, like was my last life in the year 1800 and is my future life in the year 2100, or how do we think of that? Or am I living different lives simultaneously, or is my next life in what I think of now as the past?
Yes, yes.
That's what I'm talking
yes.
about.
Our internal organs of his mind is an important element. It's like a bag in which all the tendencies and impressions that we have gathered in all our life are accumulated. They constitute our character, our behavior. So we cannot divide between different life cycles. But certain tendencies which are strongly which strongly manifest in this life may be directly related to the last life. But there are many tendencies. See, human mind, human personality, human character is so complex, difficult to explain. The innumerable thought currents, tendencies and impressions that come to the surface, we need not always act upon them, but they always emerge in our mind. So all of them come from our activities we have done, maybe in this life earlier or the last innumerable life cycles. But if we realize that we are not this body and mind complex, we are something beyond this body-mind complex, at that moment we can dissociate our true nature from these, we can cut off our true nature from these tendencies, then they subside. And that is called spiritual growth, realization of Atman. So long as we identify ourselves with the mind and body, body-mind complex, this cycle continues. Accumulated tendencies and impressions start working upon the character and behavior. By either practicing devotion or karma yoga or Vedantic contemplation, if we can dissociate ourselves from these accumulated tendencies and impressions, then the chain is cut off, the cycle comes to an end. There is no rebirth. So when you realize this identity with Atman, the cycle comes to an end. That's why I made a statement earlier. We are actually what we sincerely believe ourselves to be. Yes. Not what we profess, make a proclamation, you know. What we sincerely believe ourselves to be. That's what we are.
So along that line, you were talking about, you know, Krishna scolding Arjuna. Is there a way we can know whether we're hypocrites or not? I mean, how can we be sure that we're not?
No, Krishna is giving here an instruction for the whole humanity.
Mm-hmm.
Arjuna is
right.
A character here,
right.
You know. So in a way, we need not focus too much on Arjuna the person.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea is, very often our mind plays tricks with us.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes, you know, we postpone, we become lethargic, we become indifferent, and then we try to console ourselves. A kind of, sometimes a game of self-deception sometimes happens, you know, justifying our procrastination or postponement or lethargy. This is natural. So reading these verses, texts like Gita, will help us to avoid this problem. We are aware that there is such a thing as deceiving ourselves, deluding ourselves into a false identity. So that should be guarded against. That's the purpose of these verses. Om Shanti Shanti Shanti.